Welcome to the Oldie Literary Lunch, sponsored by Noble Caledonia, the world experts in small ship cruising.
Our final author now joins his colleague in our team as there emerged a common theme. Great men. Their stories all give cause to consider the gifts, the genius, and the flaws. Winston Churchill's A Man Alone, Yet a Man in a Million. I pity anyone who sees themselves as Churchillian. The name Boris springs to mind. Enough! Let us hear of a man literally one of a kind. And here is the man who took the picture of his and drew his portrait. Will you welcome Andrew Roberts?
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great honour to be invited to address you this afternoon, and thank you very much indeed for those for your doggerel. your Shakespearean couplets, Barry, your Shakespearean couplets. The last time I came to speak here, I was actually shouted down. And not by anybody in the audience, I hasten to add, but by one of the other speakers, by Felix Dennis, who I remember that. Yes, I'm very. He's actually dead now. I'm mildly sorry to say. Friday, the 10th of May, 1940, the day that Winston Churchill became Prime Minister. It happened at 6:30 in the evening when the King came to, when Churchill went to Buckingham Palace and the King appointed him as Prime Minister. Earlier that day, of course, at dawn, Hitler had unleashed Blitzkrieg on the West, invading Holland, Luxembourg and Belgium. And 8 years later, writing in his memoirs, Churchill said, "I felt as if I were walking with destiny and that all my past life has been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial." And what I've tried to do in my book, Walking with Churchill, Walking with Destiny, is to unpack that, to investigate the extent to which that is true, that all of his past life had been a preparation for this hour and this trial. And also to look at his extraordinary concept of personal destiny. He, from the age of 16, when he was a schoolboy at Harrow, he was almost entirely self-educated because he had to be because he went to Harrow. He told his best friend at the age of 16 that he believed that he was going to save London, he was going to save the country, and he was going to save the empire. And when you look at this incredible sense of personal destiny, that you realize that the reason that he believed this, and he told a friend this as well, was because he had survived so many extraordinary close brushes with death in his life. He'd been born 2 months premature. He had been stabbed in the stomach at prep school with a penknife. At the age of 11, he had nearly died of pneumonia. The doctors had administered brandy, both orally and rectally, which you would have thought, ladies and gentlemen, would put you off brandy for life, but in Churchill's case, it most certainly didn't. He had nearly drowned in Lake Geneva. He had knocked himself out for 3 days, jumping off a bridge. He had escaped a house fire. He had charged, of course, with the cavalry at the Battle of Omdurman, where they lost 25%, his unit lost 25% casualties. He had been ambushed on a train in the Boer War, where his unit lost 34% casualties. He'd escaped a couple of months later from a prisoner of war camp. This is a man, ladies and gentlemen, who was constantly, he'd escaped two plane crashes, three car crashes, including one that when you have a look at my book that you're yearning to buy, you'll see on the front cover this extraordinary livid scar going down the center of his forehead. And the reason for that was a car crash that he survived in December 1931 in New York. And that wasn't the end of it. In the White House in December 1941, he was raising a sash window and he had a heart attack. In 1943, he had a series of new attacks of pneumonia. At one point, his doctor asked him for some blood that they needed to test. And Churchill said, well, you can take some from my finger or my ear, and I also have an almost infinite expanse of arse. And the great thing about this extraordinary series of near-death experiences was that it just reminded him, as he said, that there were invisible wings that were beating over him, and the Almighty was keeping him for a greater task, which, of course, was to save London and save the country and save the empire. He never mentioned Jesus Christ in any of his 5.2 million words of speeches and 6.1 million words of writings, but he did mention the Almighty a lot, whose sole theological purpose seems to have been to take care of Winston Churchill. And he also complained to his wife, Clementine, that people would not give him life insurance. Ladies and gentlemen, anyone would have been insane to have given Winston Churchill life insurance. But one of the things that this sense of destiny did give him was the idea that he, because he was going to win the war, that he could be calm and relaxed in the most extraordinary series of perilous circumstances for this country. And in fact, he made jokes, and the jokes seemed to get better the more perilous the situation got. There's a marvellous moment in November 1941 when, before the Americans therefore have entered the war, when he is in a confidence motion, so theoretically his whole government could have fallen, and he was being attacked over the A-22 tank, which was rubbish, and he said that when the A-22, he told the House of Commons, when the A-22 tank and its deficiencies and its defects and its teething troubles became apparent to all, it was appropriately rechristened the Churchill. And the key word there is appropriately, because he knew that he had deficiencies and teething troubles and defects. And of course, again and again in his career, he had made terrible mistakes. He had got women's suffrage wrong. He had got the Dardanelles wrong. He had got bank crisis wrong with the gold standard. He had got the abdication crisis wrong. But from each of these things, ladies and gentlemen, he learnt. And in the Second World War, he learnt from the Dardanelles to such an extent that he never once overruled the chiefs of staff in the Second World War. So you have, therefore, somebody who is learning all the time on the job. And he has this... I have been... criticised a few times for having written this book, owing to the fact that there are no fewer than 1,009 biographies of Winston Churchill. But I take enormous solace from his chief of staff, Pug Ismay, who in 1960, when he was writing his memoirs, told President Eisenhower that he didn't believe that there could be a fully comprehensive life of Churchill until the year 2010. And I believe it. I agree with him, because it's been only in the last 10 years that we have had a cornucopia of new sources that have become available. The Queen allowed me to be the first Churchill biographer to use her father's diaries. And King George VI met Churchill for a Tuesday lunchtime every Tuesday throughout the Second World War. They served themselves from the sideboard because no servants could be present, because Churchill trusted the king implicitly with all of the greatest secrets of the state. He told him about the ultra decrypts. He told him about the nuclear bomb. He told him about everything. And these two, who might not have got on, because, of course, Churchill supported Edward VIII in the abdication crisis, and also the king had been very much in favour of appeasement. Nonetheless, during the fall of France and the Battle of Britain, and certainly by the Blitz, they became intimate, and the king called him his friend and was the only one of the prime ministers, his four prime ministers, who he called by his Christian name. We also have the war cabinet, verbatim accounts of the war cabinet. We have Ivan Maisky's diaries now, which came out in the last 4 years as well. He was the Soviet ambassador from 1932 to 43. We also have the 41 sets of papers that have been deposited at Churchill College, Cambridge, since the last major biography of him, including the 1940 diary of Mary Soames, Winston Churchill's daughter. So there has been this enormous avalanche of new papers. And I was also fortunate, the Churchill family allowed me to be the first historian to have access to the love letters of Pamela Harriman. Pamela Harriman, Churchill's daughter-in-law, who had what I think is probably kindest to say a active romantic life during the Second World War, in that, as well as marrying and having a baby by Randolph Churchill, she also had affairs with Avril Harriman, FDR's envoy, Ed Murrow, the CBS columnist, William Paley, another CBS columnist, Jock Whitney, the another very important American, General Kevin Anderson, the head of the Eighth Army, somebody who we only know of by the name Jerry, and Sir Charles Portal, the head of the RAF. There is an actual, there is a moment during the Yalta conference where three men are writing love letters to Pamela Harriman. Although I had exclusive access to her love letters, nobody had exclusive access to her. And it was a, it's therefore something that is very exciting for an historian to have all of these different new things, all in the coming in the last 10 years, which means that one can, I believe, write a fully comprehensive life of the greatest Englishman who ever lived. Thank you very much.
For more about the Oldie magazine and the lunches, go to theoldie.co.uk.